So welcome everyone. My name is Julian Savulescu. I'm the UHERO Chair in Practical Ethics and welcome to the UHERO Lectures for 2020. The first UHERO Lecture is jointly held with the Moral Philosophy Seminar and I'll be passing over to Ed and Jeremy in a moment to formally introduce this year's speaker, Michael Otsuka, who is Professor of Philosophy at the London School of Economics. The title of his series is How to Pool Risks Across Generations, the Case for Collective Pensions. Michael is the 17th UHERO lecturer. Past lecturers have included Jeff McMahon, Peter Singer, Francis Cam, Philip Pettit, Janet Radcliffe-Richards, Tim Scanlon, Christine Korsgaard, Elizabeth Anderson, and Samuel Scheffler. The lectures were founded in 2004 and have been funded by the UHERO Foundation on Ethics and Education. And they're accompanied by the UHERO series in Practical Ethics, published by Oxford University Press. The 2021 lectures will be given by Professor Howard McGarry at Rutgers University, and the timing will depend on the COVID-19 pandemic. So without further ado, let me hand over to Ed Lamb and Jeremy Fix to introduce today's lecturer and the speaker in more detail.
Well, thanks very much, Julian. I'm Ed Lamb. I'm the co-convener of the Moral Philosophy Seminar. It gives me great pleasure today to introduce Michael Otsuka, Professor of Philosophy at the London School of Economics. Not only does Mike's work exemplify the virtues of clarity, simplicity, and precision, but he has played a significant role in many of the major debates in moral and political philosophy for the last 30 years. More recently, his work has taken a more practical turn, focusing on issues such as risk pooling, insurance, and pensions. His lectures will make the case for collective pensions, beginning today with the case for a funded pension with a defined benefit.
All right, thank you very much, Ed and Julian. So let me put up a slide. Right. Okay, so I'd like to begin by taking us back in time to 1990, or actually the mid-1990s. So I've chosen that decade because it's the last of a golden age for defined benefit pension schemes in the United Kingdom. And we're going to have a look at the books of the valuation of one such scheme in 1996. And I'm sure that you can guess the scheme will be well known to many people. It's called USS, the University's Superannuation Scheme. Now, for those of you who aren't completely familiar, USS consists of the roughly 70 UK universities that were founded from medieval times through to the late 1960s, plus the roughly 70 Oxford and Cambridge colleges. Now, back in 1996, and actually for most of USS's existence, it promised members a pension equal to 1/80th of one's final salary for every year of employment in exchange for employer and member contributions. There was also guaranteed revaluation of one's pension each year by RPI increases in inflation. Now that was how the benefit was defined, defined benefit. The promise was modeled on the pensions provided in the public sector to civil servants and school teachers at the time. Now, the method employed to value the scheme back then was roughly along the lines that funded public sector schemes are valued in the United States to this day. And in certain key respects, this is the method of valuation to which the union, now representing the interests of scheme members and their actuarial advisor, First Actuarial, would like USS to return to, at least insofar as current regulations permit. Now, they've argued that by returning to what they regard as sound actuarial and investment practices of the past, it can be shown to be possible to continue to fund the current level of defined benefit promise at a contribution rate far lower than what both the pensions regulator and the trustee that administers the pension scheme are demanding. So, question, should occupational pension schemes return to these practices of valuing and funding a pension scheme? Now, that's the question I'm going to set out to address today. I don't want to leave you in too much suspense. My answer to the question will be at least a qualified yes, we should return to these historical practices. Okay, so I need to say a few words about how a pension scheme is valued. I'm going to be examining the method of valuing a pension scheme today. Well, we're going back to 1996, very different time for valuation. As of 1996, the assets in the pension fund were valued at 108% of the liabilities that had been accrued to date. Now, this valuation of the assets is greater than the liabilities implied that the scheme was in surplus. It was also projected that the scheme would be able to continue to make that same 180th final salary defined benefit pension promise in each future year at the cost of only 20% of salaries. Well, question, were these reasonable and prudent assumptions grounded in sound methods of valuing pension schemes generally? And if they were, why is USS now proposing that nothing less than an overall contribution twice as high, 40% of salaries, will now be sufficient to provide what is actually a much less generous than the 180th final salary that was promised in 1996. Now, to value pensions liabilities or promises, the scheme actuary needs to predict what people's final salaries would be, I mean, under the final salary scheme, how long people will live in retirement, looking at mortality tables on average, and what the future rate of inflation would be because pensions go up by RPI inflation. And then with these assumptions, then the actuary projects the stream of cash flows that would be paid out of the fund as pensions to scheme members in retirement decades out into the future. Now, in order to convert the sum of all these future cash flows into a single figure that captures their present value, what the actuary did and does to this day is discount this sum by the expected rate of return on the assets in the scheme. And this is the so-called discount rate, which is by far the main source of controversy regarding the proper valuation of a pension scheme. So the higher the expected rate of return on the assets in future years, the lower the level of assets and pension contributions now needed to fully fund pension promises. Let's take us back to 1996. Screenshot of the, or a photograph of the cover of the valuation document in 1996. Now back then, as you can see, the discount rate, the assumed rate of return on investments was 8.5% per annum. That was their estimate of the returns on investments that would be achieved on the scheme's assets per annum on average over the next several decades. It was also assumed that inflation, RPI back then, would be 5% per annum. Now, though these will strike you as, I think, very high assumptions, especially the investment return assumption, these assumptions were actually in line with and actually a little bit more conservative than the more general actuarial practices at the time. Now, since for schemes such as USS, the liabilities pretty much rose and fell with inflation, what was most relevant was the margin between the investment assumption and the inflation assumption. Now, USS calculated that this margin was 3.5%, which is to say they assumed that the assets would grow by 3.5% each year in real RPI inflation adjusted terms, RPI plus 3.5. Question, well, how sound were these assumptions? Now, in order to answer this question, we can actually draw now on almost a quarter of a century of actual returns on various types of assets since 1996. Now, on the basis of USS's modeling or simulating of the historical portfolio, it's actually moved now to a very different portfolio, but on the basis of their modeling, it appears that the scheme would in fact have achieved the assumed annualized real return of over 3.5%. I mean, not quite the nominal return, but they would have got 3.5% over RPI, at least even up to 31 July 2020, if the scheme had remained invested as it was invested back then. So why then is the scheme now perceived to be in such financial difficulty? Well, it mainly comes down to the fact that for its latest valuation, just issued for consultation, USS is proposing a discount rate, which assumes that the assets in the scheme will actually shrink by 0.2% against RPI each year for the next 30 years, rather than growing by RPI plus 3.5%. Now, largely owing to such more pessimistic assumptions, USS is now calling for a rise in contributions to at least 40% of salaries, double what the contributions were in 1996, to fund what is, as I mentioned now, a much less generous pension than what was on offer in 1996. So why is it that the current discount rate is now so much lower than the 3.5% over RPI that was assumed in 1996? Well, there are three reasons, I think. First, expected real long-term returns on investments are now lower than they were in 1996. So on USS's most recent best estimates of expected returns on assets, the portfolio into which the scheme was invested in 1996 is expected to grow by a bit less than 3% per annum above RPI over the next 30 years. Now, note that USS's current best estimates of real returns on equities, property, and bonds, these estimates are therefore not that much less optimistic than they were back in 1996 and prior to the dot-com bubble bursting in the early 2000s, I mean, prior to the global financial crisis of 2007 to 2008, and obviously prior to the current coronavirus pandemic. I mean, you would have thought that maybe they would have adjusted more so, but thinking that returns won't be as high as was thought in 1996 isn't the main reason why the discount rate is now so low. It just brings it down to 3% above RPI. Well, the second reason is much more significant for the lower discount rate. The second reason is that the portfolio out of which USS will fund its defined benefit promises is now much more weighted towards bonds than the historical 1996 portfolio. Now, like many defined benefit portfolios back in the 90s, USS was about 80% invested in equities. And that was sort of the investment patterns up until around the global financial crisis. Now, the portfolio into which USS now plans to invest over the next several decades will actually end up averaging out, by contrast, to 2/3 bonds. So USS is shifting out of equities and into bonds, in spite of the fact that it actually expects equities to outperform UK government bonds by a huge amount, about 5.5 to 6% per annum. And USS also expects equities, stocks, and bonds to outperform corporate bonds by about 2.75% over the next 30 years. And so this shift from equities to bonds significantly reduces the expected returns on the portfolio, down from 3.0 above RPI if they'd remained invested 80% in equities to 1.25% above RPI. Now, these returns I've been quoting are those that one can expect on average per annum over the long term. Now, back in the 1990s, contributions were set on the basis of such just pure best estimate expected returns on the assets. Now, by contrast, USS's current valuation, and in fact, all of its valuations from 2008 onwards, have set contributions on the basis of more conservative assumptions that one will have a significantly greater than 50% chance of achieving. This is the third reason why the discount rate is now so much lower than it was in 1996. Now, for the most recent valuation, contributions have been proposed on the basis of returns that one can expect to achieve about 3/4 of the time. Instead of roughly 50% of the time, they're moving all the way up to, you know, assumptions on the basis of what can be achieved 3/4 of the time. And this is in fact how USS interprets a requirement of current regulations from 2008, applying from 2008, the 2008 valuation, that the discount rate must, quote, be chosen prudently. And once we prudently adjust the discount rate, the assumed returns on assets drops from 1.25 above RPI to the 0.2% below RPI. or CPI plus 5%. Now, when pensions contributions are set on the assumption that long-term returns on the assets into which they'll be invested will fall short of RPI, as opposed to this assumption that prevailed in the 90s that returns will exceed RPI by 3.5%, it really shouldn't come as a surprise that members and employers are now required to pay much more for a less good defined benefit pension. So the question I want to ask now is there a sound justification for this huge lowering of the discount rate? Now, to answer this question, we have to ask the following question. How do we set the discount rate? What's the appropriate way in which to discount the pensions promises many years in the future in order to convert those liabilities into a single present value? Okay, well, let me just turn to the current UK code of practice of the pensions regulator. It gives us two different methods of setting the discount rate, which correspond with two very different philosophies about how to set the discount rate. So the code says that the discount rate must be chosen prudently. That's the downward adjustment I talked about. Taking into account either the following two things, either the yield on assets held by the scheme to fund future benefits and the anticipated future investment returns, and or the market redemption yield on government or high quality, which is to say high quality corporate bonds. Now in the 1996 valuation, which I described earlier, USS followed the first of the two bulleted approaches, save for one crucial difference. Back then there was no requirement, as I mentioned, to discount the returns prudently. Now accordingly, USS discounted on the basis of their best estimates of the long-term average rate of returns on the various assets in the scheme without this pessimistic adjustment. Now, I'm going to argue that USS approach back then was actually the right one, save for the fact that they didn't make this prudent downward adjustment. And you just add this prudence in and basically USS was following the right approach. Before I defend USS's approach back then, what I want to do is turn to an influential case grounded in a theory of value from financial economics for adoption of the second approach. And you can see from my red X that I've not been convinced by the financial economics case for the second approach. Now, here's the financial economics case. According to this argument, the discounting of pensions liabilities has nothing to do with the return on the assets held in the scheme's pension fund. Rather, irrespective of whether these assets are actually held by the scheme, what they believe is that the sound measure of the value of the liabilities is the return on those financial assets that, quote, match the liabilities by providing streams of cash flows that match or approximate those of a promised pension in their magnitude, in their duration, and in the level of certainty that these cash flows will be delivered. Well, here's the theory behind such a discount rate. Irrespective of how the pension fund is invested, whether it's invested in equities or bonds, these liability matching securities provide an accurate measure of the value of the liability, which is the promised pension, in the following respect. Anybody should be willing to exchange the pensions payments they've been promised for a portfolio of financial assets, which are guaranteed to as high a degree to produce the promised cash flows. And these will be bonds of the right temporal duration, long-dated bonds, bonds also with inflation protection, and also bonds that reflect the credit risk of the employer who's making the pension promise, the risk that that employer may actually not be able to deliver on that promise. I think the financial economics approach makes a lot of sense for the valuation of a pensions promise understood as the price it makes sense to pay to purchase this promise from someone. So the financial economics valuation is actually akin to the sorts of valuations with which we're familiar, such as the valuation of a house, where we're trying to ascertain how much money that property would exchange for if placed on the market, or what it would exchange for. I think, though, it can be shown, however, that a so-called actuarial valuation of a pension's liability is actually very different from a determination of the market exchange value of that liability. And in fact, an actuarial valuation, that thing that used to come around every 3 years, now tends to come around every year or two with USS, an actuarial valuation doesn't actually involve a valuation of the liabilities. Rather, the purpose of such a valuation is as follows. It's to determine whether the pension's contributions placed into the scheme to date have been invested in a manner that is, quote, sufficient and appropriate to make provision for the scheme's liabilities. And this purpose is captured by a term known as the technical provisions. Now, as it's stated in the UK Pensions Act 2004, I mean, you can find it in other countries as well, every scheme is subject to a requirement that it must have sufficient and appropriate assets to cover its technical provisions. And the scheme's technical provisions means the amount required on an actuarial calculation to make provision for the scheme's liabilities. I want to stress the amount required to provide for the liabilities is not necessarily the value, market or otherwise, of these liabilities. What I want to turn to now are two arguments for why the yield of a bond portfolio that matches the liabilities does not necessarily provide the discount rate for the technical provisions as we've just defined it. Here's my first argument. My first argument begins with the observation that existing and sound regulatory practices typically require that a weaker, less creditworthy sponsoring employer of a pension scheme needs to put in more contributions in order to make provision for a given pension promise than a stronger, more creditworthy sponsoring employer needs to put into the pension fund. And the rationale is pretty obvious. One can allow a more creditworthy sponsor, which is to say, and stronger in pensions terminology, to put in less by way of contributions now because we know that they're more able to put in more contributions later if returns on the assets into which these contributions have been invested turn out lower than expected. But a less creditworthy sponsor's pensions promise will be worth less to a worker than a more creditworthy sponsor's promise of the same pension payments for the simple reason that a worker will be rightly less certain that he'll end up receiving the full amount of the pension he's been promised. So a defined benefit pension that Trinity College Cambridge promises will be worth more than a pension promise of a single employer scheme whose sole sponsor is on the edge of insolvency. And it doesn't follow, however, that Trinity College must be required to put more money into its pension fund than an employer on the brink of insolvency in order to make sufficient provision for its pensions. I mean, given the primary objective of pensions regulations to ensure that the benefits promised to members are paid, the very opposite is true. Yet setting the technical provisions as the market exchange value, I mean, saying how much you have to provide for, setting that as the market exchange value of a pension's promise would have the perverse consequence of requiring Trinity College to put in more money to secure its pension's promise than an employer on the edge of insolvency. And that's absurd. Now I turn to my second argument for why the bond yield of a portfolio that matches the liabilities doesn't necessarily provide the discount rate for the technical provisions as defined. Remember, the technical provisions tells us the extent to which one must make provision for pensions promises by funding them in advance rather than as and when the promised payments come due. So the technical provisions is therefore essentially a collateral requirement. And as my earlier discussion has revealed, it follows from the nature of a pensions promise that bonds will provide a closer match to and a better substitute for a pension than other financial assets, such as equities. But as I should now demonstrate, it is, however, a fallacy to maintain that the bond-like nature of a pensions liability gives rise to any requirement to fund it out of matching bonds, or if not that, at least funding it to a level sufficient to purchase these matching bonds. So here's the argument. A regulated defined benefit pension is essentially a non-tradable bond issued by means of the trustee by a corporation to an employee. The employee issues a bond to you in exchange for contributions. A corporation may, however, issue unsecured corporate bonds to their employees that pretty much replicate most of the characteristics of a defined benefit pension. Moreover, regulatory requirements for unsecured corporate bonds don't extend much beyond provisions to guard against fraud. Now, since these corporate bonds would be unsecured, they lack any funding or collateral requirements. Now, the relative lack of regulation of such corporate bonds renders it difficult to sustain the view that defined benefit pensions must be funded up to a level sufficient to allow for the purchase of matching bonds to the liabilities. This is because the mere fact that a defined benefit pension involves a bond-like promise does not establish that it must be funded to this level. For if it did, then by parity of reasoning, one would need to insist that a corporation may not issue a bond unless it secures it with assets that match the liability. It would, however, defeat the point of issuing corporate bonds if one were required to secure them in this manner from the outset, since then one would hardly be able to make use of the revenue from the sale of bonds to invest in anything other than the securing of that very bond. One could no longer issue a bond to raise money to spend on other things. Rather, one would have to use up the money from the sale of the bond when it's issued to purchase a comparable bond to serve as collateral, and that's absurd. So it's therefore a mistake for financial economists to claim that the bond-like nature of a pension's promise gives rise to a requirement that it be secured by means of funding to the level of the value of a liability, a portfolio of liability matching bonds. Okay, I've shown that financial economics doesn't provide a justification for insisting that a pension's promise must be secured by contributions ring-fenced in a fund guarded by a trustee whose level should be set so high that it's possible to purchase a bond portfolio that comes very close to matching the defined benefit liability. The question I want to turn to now is the following. Is there, however, a sound regulatory justification? And this is really what the question is about, not about financial economics and their theory of value, but is there a regulatory justification grounded in sound public policy considerations rather than the theory of value for saying that you have to provide for pensions promises up to the level of liability matching bonds? And I now turn to this question, I think this reframed question, properly framed question about setting the technical provisions. What I want to do now is present what I take to be the strongest argument for the relevance of the yield on the liability matching bond portfolio to the setting of the technical provisions, to the setting of the discount rate for the purpose of determining whether the assets held by the scheme are sufficient to provide for the pensions that have been promised to members. Now, recall that I mentioned earlier that the stronger the sponsoring employer, the higher the assumed rate of return on the assets by which the regulator will allow them to discount the liabilities. It's based on a theory that a financially strong employer is more capable than a weaker employer of underwriting a portfolio of growth assets, such as equities, stocks, and bonds. Now, it's on account of what's called the equity risk premium that a growth portfolio will have a higher expected return than a government bond portfolio, where the promised rate of return of a bond portfolio, at least from a reliable government, is regarded as risk-free. Now, the higher expected return on equities is regarded as the compensation necessary to induce individuals to purchase equities, given the greater risks involved in holding stocks in comparison with bonds. Now, a regulator will, however, insensibly, if someone says, I want to invest in equities, require the sponsor to underwrite this risk. The sponsor will need to demonstrate that they would be able to put more assets into the pension fund in the event that the returns on growth assets are less good than expected. Now, a weak sponsor who's less able to demonstrate the ability to make good large funding shortfalls will actually be required to invest expensively at the outset in financial assets that run a much less great risk of falling short of covering the pension's promises. A sponsoring employer who's so weak that they can't demonstrate any ability to make good any shortfall, even a year or two into the future, will be required to almost entirely pre-fund the pension promise at the very outset when they make the promise by investing at the outset in assets that come close to perfectly matching the pension's liability in their duration and magnitude, or at least putting enough money in the fund at the outset that you can purchase such a portfolio. Now, long-dated inflation-linked government bonds come closest among financial assets, apart from insurance company annuities, to perfectly matching a pension's liability. Such a portfolio will approximate the composition of a portfolio that actually matches an insurance company's annuity. And therefore, a very weak sponsor will be required at great expense to discount pensions liabilities at something close to the risk-free government bond yield. Now, a stronger sponsor is not required to invest in a portfolio of bonds that match the liabilities. They'll be permitted to invest at far less expense in a growth portfolio whose higher returns are expected to cover the promised pensions payments in future years. They'll be allowed to do so, so long as they can demonstrate an ability to underwrite the risks by showing how they'll deliver on their pensions promises in the event that the returns on these risky assets are less good than expected. So how might they demonstrate this? Well, here's one way that USS has proposed, so-called safe harbor. One way of underwriting the risk is showing that in the event that the downside risks of the growth portfolio materialize, one will still have the wherewithal to purchase a liability matching bond portfolio that has this very high chance of covering the promises. Now, it's for this reason, among others, that the regulator pays close attention to the extent to which the assumed rate of return on growth assets held by the scheme, which is to say the discount rate on growth assets, exceeds the risk-free rate of government bonds. A sponsor who holds fewer growth assets in the scheme, or a sponsor who has growth assets worth less in the scheme than liability matching assets, is going to need to demonstrate the following: that he has resources to make good the gap between the lower price of a growth portfolio with the higher expected returns and the higher price of a bond portfolio with the lower expected returns, even in the event that this gap grows even larger on account of either a fall in the stock market or a decline in the yield of bonds. Now, the useful metaphor of USS's chief risk officer is the following. He's described liability matching bond portfolio as a safe harbor to lock down the assets that must be within affordable reach of the sponsor. I want to show you a graph now. This graph, two graphs, provide a key to maybe the key to understanding the difficulty that defined benefit pension schemes are in now, given the focus on the significance of bond yields. Now, we can see from this graph that back in the mid-90s, the risk-free rate on long-dated government bonds was actually a good deal higher than the risk-free rate is now. And in fact, back in the mid-90s, the risk-free rate on government bonds that matched pensions liabilities was so high that even though USS was heavily invested in equities and assuming a very high 8.5% rate of return, so putting very few assets in at the outset and assuming that it would mostly come through returns on investment, USS nevertheless had more than enough assets in the fund in 1996 to cover the purchase of liability matching bonds. Back in 1996, USS was 125% funded on a solvency basis, which was pegged to the cost of purchasing a mixture of index-linked and fixed-interest sterling securities that replicated the portfolio of an insurance company's annuity. So back in 1996, there was plenty of money to spare in the scheme if you wanted to move all the way over to a buyout by an insurance company. Well, at its most recent 2008 valuation, instead of being 125% funded on this buyout solvency basis, USS was only 56% funded on a solvency basis, which is to say that the assets held in the scheme at the 2008 valuation, they haven't yet figured out the solvency valuation for 2020. For the 2018 valuation, was worth only 56% of the cost of the purchase of this liability matching bond portfolio. So employers would have to have come up with an extra 50 billion. I mean, talk about deficits, 50 billion pounds in 2018 in order to raise enough money to purchase such a liability matching bond portfolio that replicates an insurance company's annuity portfolio. Therefore, unlike in the 1990s and the early 2000s, when the safe harbor of a liability matching bond portfolio could be purchased in exchange for the assets in the scheme with money to spare, today such a bond portfolio is far beyond the reach of what employers could afford to move to in the short term. Now, USS doesn't actually require that the employer must be able immediately to move to a liability matching bond portfolio. And USS's current requirement is that a safe harbor must be within affordable reach in the following respect. It must be possible to raise sufficient revenues by means of extra contributions of 10% of payroll over the next three decades in order to enhance the market value of the assets in the portfolio to a level which makes it possible to purchase a liability matching bond portfolio, and actually not quite as stringent requirement of the liability matching portfolio as a buyout portfolio. Now, why have they chosen three decades of an extra 10% in contributions? Well, the time period of three decades has been chosen because it's been determined that the higher education sector will at least collectively be in sufficiently strong financial condition to pay such extra contributions for at least the next three decades. The covenant is strong for at least that long. But bond yields, as we can see from the graph, are now so low, and the liability matching portfolio so expensive, that USS would now fall short of being able to purchase a liability matching portfolio even with 30 years of significantly enhanced contributions. So the question now is, well, does the defined benefit scheme really need, as USS insists it does, to be within affordable reach of a liability matching bond portfolio? Or might a defined benefit scheme prudently fund pensions promises out of a portfolio of growth assets whose value falls so far short of that of a liability matching portfolio that one couldn't afford to purchase such a portfolio even after three decades of an extra 10% pensions contributions? Well, I think the answer is no, we don't need the safe harbor. And here's why such a safe harbor is unnecessary. So long as one builds in a prudent margin by which the returns on growth assets might fall short of a best estimate while still covering the costs of promised pensions, the risks of remaining largely invested in growth assets are minimal for an open, ongoing, cash flow positive scheme with a long investment horizon, such as USS. Now, it's recently been calculated that returns as modest as CPI plus 1.2%, which translates now into RPI plus 0.5%, that returns only that low are all that's needed to fully fund the current USS defined benefit pension promise out of contributions as low as 26% of payroll, which is back what we were paying a couple of years ago. USS's best estimate of returns on its current portfolio, which is now 65% weighted towards growth assets, they're going to be moving towards bonds in the future, USS's best estimates of returns on its current 65% equities and property portfolio is about CPI plus 3.2% or RPI plus 2.5%. That's their best guess as to what returns they'll get per annum. And this is comfortably 2% above the needed return of CPI plus 1.2% to fund our current promise at 26% contributions. Seems like quite a margin of prudence. Now, there is, of course, a risk that growth assets will fall more than 2% below their expected return and therefore fail to cover the promised pensions. And the question is, well, how great is this risk of falling below the margin of prudence? Well, stochastic modeling that USS is engaged in shows that higher risk investments tend to perform better over the long term and that the probability of loss decreases over time. And this is replicated by many other people. So it seems relatively safe so long as you can hold growth assets over the long term. Unfortunately, however, the following significant downside risk remains. As USS also points out, and this is did another stochastic modeling, the potential size of any loss that occurs increases with time as well. And in particular, the magnitude of the worst possible outcome increases with time. And moreover, it appears to be a concern regarding such extreme downside risk, which actually explains the existence of demand for long-dated bonds issued by governments and other institutions with excellent credit ratings. So as Exley, Maeda, and Smith explain in this really influential piece defending the financial economics approach to evaluating pensions liabilities, the belief, the true belief that it's highly likely in the long term that equities will generate sufficient returns to cover one's liabilities, quote, manifestly fails to explain why anyone would be prepared to purchase long-dated bonds at their market price if they can be synthesized for so much less out of a portfolio of equities as is being proposed. The key must lie in the unlikely event where the equities fail to be adequate to explain why people would purchase bonds. Although the probability of this event may be small, it bears heavily on the minds of investors as a whole, at least those who buy bonds. And they say, we can see why. A promise which holds fast when everything else has collapsed all around is potentially very valuable. Moreover, a funded defined benefit promise is just the sort of thing that one is meant to be able to rely on, even in adverse circumstances in which everything else has collapsed all around. So we can see that in the midst of a global pandemic, which has given rise to record-breaking recession and unemployment, defined benefit pensions promises are still paid on time and in full by private funded pension schemes. But as Exley, Maeda, and Smith note, if anyone could synthesize equities into assets that provide the same cash flow as bonds, come what may, more cheaply, then nobody would ever purchase long-dated bonds. There is, however, clearly high demand for such bonds. So how do we respond to this challenge? Well, to respond to these challenges, we need to do the following. We need to show that at least some defined benefit pension schemes are actually in a better position than others to manage the downside risk of equities. Even though others find it rational to purchase bonds because the downside risks of equities are too great for them to manage, the explanation has to be that, well, defined benefit schemes have certain opportunities to manage the risk of equities that are not widely available and that other people have to resort to bonds to manage. Well, how might we show this? Well, here I think is how a defined benefit pension scheme can navigate the open seas of equities even when too far from the safe harbor of a liability matching bond portfolio in the future, if necessary. So here's how a scheme can hunker down and ride out the vortex of even a large drop in equities. So long as the scheme can be foreseen to be cash flow positive for the next several decades, as in the case of USS, there's actually no need to quickly repair our deficit in funding in order to ensure that pensions are paid as they fall due. It's because these pensions involve many small and predictable payments that stretch several decades into the future, an ongoing, enduring, open, cash flow positive scheme can therefore safely spread out deficit recovery payments over a long period of time. For example, the three decades over which USS's covenant has been rated strong can spread out deficit recovery repayments to make good a funding shortfall over three decades in order to recover from even very large losses without, in so doing, running the risk of defaulting on the promises of the pensions they promise to pay as they fall due. Now, it's here that the multi-employer nature of certain defined benefit schemes, such as USS, plays a crucial role. In USS, 140 institutions, even if not every single employer can be counted on to be around and financially strong enough to make deficit recovery payments that are spread out over the next three decades, the UK higher education sector as a collective can be counted on to endure and remain sufficiently financially solvent for at least that long. Now, the so-called last man standing mutuality of USS ensures that there will be this enduring corporate body capable of making good on debts whose repayments have been amortized over several decades. Now, on the last man standing arrangement, if any one employer in the scheme becomes insolvent, responsibility to make good any underfunding of their promises is automatically shared out by the other employers, spread out among them through small increases in their contributions. Now, this last man standing structure is a form of insurance on the principle of spreading of losses, in this case from insolvency, evenly and thinly among the large number of remaining solvent universities. And this is the insurance of a mutual association, which predates the rise of sophisticated financial instruments. This is a form of insurance through mutualization that doesn't rely on a transaction with an outside insurance company or a government agency to secure protection, which is expensive these days, expensively underwritten by a bond portfolio. But because it allows for long-term investment in equities in the way I've explained, the insurance of a mutual association is now more cost-effective than insurance that requires the backing of bonds, given how low the bond yield is now. The mutuality of the 140 or so UK universities and Oxbridge colleges that form the membership of USS provides insurance against the systemic risks of a fall in the value of their assets as a result of recession, global financial crisis, pandemic, or the like. Now, we saw that the insolvency risk, I'm seeing some comments in the chat box. Are things all right? I mean, I'm seeing a bit of flickering.
It's just somebody that's putting a question that I'll call on when we get to the Q&A session, so nothing for you to worry about.
Okay, thanks, great. We saw that insolvency risk in last man standing scheme is spread out geographically in space across all the sponsoring employers. By contrast, systemic investment risk, I mean, investment risk that's systematic, when the stock market crashes, it affects everyone, can also be spread out. But in this case, rather than being spread out geographically, you can't do that. I mean, fall in the stock market affects everyone. We spread out a systemic fall in the stock market across future time slices of the multi-generational collective body that constitutes a multi-employer scheme. So we spread out the risks over time rather than over space. So pensions promises are secured by the ability to make good shortfalls on the returns on equities through extra contributions spread out over multiple decades. This method of underwriting investment risk provides an alternative to the requirement of remaining within this affordable 30-year journey to purchase of a liability matching bond portfolio. Now, with the insurance underpinning of last man standing mutuality, financial assets are freed up for constant and long-term investment in a manner that seeks high returns, rather than being tied down to the need to provide collateral in the form of liability matching bonds to secure the pensions. Now, this discussion underscores the importance of keeping defined benefit schemes open and cash flow positive for as long as possible. And the most effective means of keeping defined benefit schemes open for as long as possible is through multi-employer arrangements that are wide and inclusive. So although individual employers, even industries, will come and go, an economy of producers of goods and services is here to stay. And there's therefore a public policy justification for bringing producers together into large networks of multi-employer schemes like USS, where they will be stronger together. And to achieve this, and this is a regulatory public policy issue, not a matter of financial economics valuation, not a matter of valuation theory. To achieve this, the state should extend tax relief, especially or maybe even only to those occupational pension schemes that enter into such multi-employer arrangements, which they would also facilitate to make sure that everyone can enter into a multi-employer arrangement. The state should therefore provide an incentive for firms to engage in such risk pooling for mutual advantage that gives rise to such an enduring body that it can spread the risks of drops in equity safely over long periods of time. Now, even if we provide such tax incentives to join together, for firms to join together into multi-employer last man standing arrangements, there will be some employers who fear that they'll actually end up the last man standing, and those employers may choose to go it alone, even at great cost. Last man standing arrangement, because ultimately the last solvent employer bears responsibility to deliver all the pensions of the members of the scheme in the event of the insolvencies of all the other employers in the scheme. And Trinity College Cambridge famously did just this when they recently withdrew from USS at fairly great expense. They bought out their liabilities at the very high expense of an insurance company. I want to draw this lecture to close by noting a striking feature of the actuarial advice on which Trinity College chose to withdraw. This advice identified a move to a liability matching portfolio as actually the major source of risk to the sector as a whole. The scenario illustrating the existential threat that US's last man standing arrangement might pose to Trinity involved the following: the risk of high deficit recovery contributions caused by, well, a valuation like this one we're seeing now, and then leading to the closure of defined benefit, and then the subsequent shift of the portfolio towards an expensive liability matching bond portfolio in order to secure the funding of past pension promises. The increasing cost of funding this portfolio leads, under the scenario, to the insolvency of universities, which then drives up the deficit contributions required of the remaining universities, which then leads to further insolvencies to the point where Trinity College, perhaps with All Souls and maybe a couple other Oxford and Cambridge colleges, are left the last solvent employer standing. So it's noteworthy that what prompted Trinity College to leave the scheme was not, therefore, the risk the DB scheme posed by remaining open while invested primarily in equities and other growth assets. In fact, the chief financial officer of Cambridge has been making the case for being able to fund the scheme prudently at 26% contributions, 65% growth assets. So it wasn't the risk that was the scenario that prompted Trinity College to withdraw of the USS scheme remaining open and ongoing funded out of equities. Rather, it was a risk of the insolvency of multiple employers caused by the high cost of moving to this liability matching bond portfolio. Now, in their latest valuation document, USS actually confirms Trinity College's fears when they sketch extreme downside scenarios in which they might call on all employers' available income and assets. These involve circumstances in which USS intervenes to force the sector at great expense to purchase this liability matching bond portfolio. They force them to do so out of fear that if they don't act now, they'll reach a point at which even all the available income and assets in the higher education sector are insufficient to cover the great cost of such a bond portfolio. So you see on the screen, USS writes the following in their latest valuation document. These scenarios are sufficiently extreme that there's likely to have been institutional failures across a substantial portion of the higher education sector. And somewhat chillingly, they say, moreover, in these scenarios, the trustees, namely USS's call on employers' assets in these scenarios would not necessarily be restrained by the possibility of inflicting additional harm on the higher education sector. So what this passage implies is that USS is prepared to destroy the entire UK higher education sector to ensure that defined benefit pensions promises laid down in the past are paid in full. Well, let's grant, if only for the sake of argument, that expensive investment in a liability matching bond portfolio is the most effective means of securing pensions promises that have been laid down in past years. We can also accept as a matter of current legal fact that it's a primary duty of the regulator to secure such past promises. Nevertheless, the justification of such a duty involves normative considerations of public policy. Such a duty does not follow from any truths in financial economics regarding the proper method of evaluating a defined benefit pensions liability. And moreover, there cannot be a sound public policy justification so much weight on the securing of past pensions promises, even at such high cost, that it destroys the ability of those sponsors to lay down any future pensions promises, including to the very same workers they promised pensions in the past, while also threatening the very solvency of such employers. For a large multi-employer scheme with a strong covenant whose horizon is long, there's no sound case for the requirement to fund pensions promises against the benchmark of a liability matching bond portfolio. Such a scheme can instead be funded prudently on the basis of the higher returns on equities that are expected. It's only through the enactment of regulations and tax incentives, which will give rise to more such multi-employer schemes, that we'll be able to provide affordable, secure, funded pensions for people in their retirement. So a scheme such as USS ought to be viewed as a model rather than a cautionary tale. It ought to be regarded as the solution rather than a problem. Thank you very much. Thanks.